Well, hello everyone and welcome to yet another podcast from theoneliner.com. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and in Glasgow is Scott Morris.
Good evening, delighted to meet you.
And in Falkirk, but probably no less delighted to meet you, it's Drew Tavendale.
How do you?
We're a bit jam-packed tonight because it's been quite a while since we last spoke to you, so without further ado, let's crack on. Seasoned police officer Thomas Craven has his world shattered when his activist daughter Emma is murdered on his own doorstep in a shooting he assumes was intended for him. It soon transpires, however, that Emma was always the target and that her death is part of a corporate-slash-government cover-up resulting from her involvement in the murky world of big business. Determined to realise the truth behind his daughter's slaying, Craven, played by Mel Gibson, finds his investigations attracting the attention of a government agent by the name of Jedburgh, whose remit is to remove all trace of the hit and any political involvement. A remake of the massively acclaimed six-part BBC drama of the same name first aired in 1985, and which dealt with British nuclear power policy at the time, many will question the need to retread ground first trodden on 25 years ago. Even more surprisingly, it's the original series director Martin Campbell who is once again at the helm here, potentially running the risk of sullying the very property which brought him to Hollywood's attention in the first place for seemingly little gain. It seems like an odd career choice for Martin Campbell at this point, Scott. How does Edge of Darkness, the screen adaptation or the film adaptation, pan out?
Well, I've not seen the television series, so I cannot possibly comment on how it compares to that.
It's very good.
What I can say about this, at least, is that Edge of Darkness is a perfectly reasonable entertainment. You'd probably be well placed to put your shrewdness at the door. The plot twists, and there's quite a few of them as this unfolds, demand the kind of levels of credulity that is not normally seen in nature. But that aside, it's dependably enjoyable. Gibson does his kind of standard issue stoic investigative role fairly well. Ray Winston even shows up again playing Ray Winston to reasonable effect. It's a little bit too closely hitched to the whole conspiracy theory nonsense for its own good, perhaps. It does go to some extent that it really better not going to, and it's not the sort of film that's really going to bother anyone's top 10 list, but for what it is, it's a perfectly enjoyable thriller. It's paced fastly enough that you're never going to be left for too long sitting wondering about the somewhat stretched twists that are unfolding about you, so it kind of gets away with it on that level, and it's for the most part fairly enjoyable, decent performances all round, won't bother anyone's top 10 list, but it's a perfectly fine film.
Drew, nothing more than disposable entertainment?
No, not really. It's an entirely competent thriller. Mel Gibson is as engaging and likeable as he typically is. You get some enjoyment out of watching it and then probably never think about it again, which is a good thing because it doesn't bear any scrutiny at all. What I would say though is if you're looking for something to see in a cinema just now, you could do worse than picking this, but if you were looking for a decent thriller with a wee bit of conspiracy chucked in, I would certainly urge you to check out last year's State of Play rather than this.
It seems like interesting timing. This has come out in quite a sort of quiet period here, and it's done quite well in the box office. Is this Mel trying to gingerly worm his way back into our affections after his recent spate of, how shall we describe them, indiscretions?
Well, it's hard to keep track of Mel Gibson's indiscretions by this point. Isn't he always doing something, fucking up, then making a film to try and atone for it in big exclamation marks? So I don't really know how that works out. One thing I did mention to Drew when we came out of the cinema, and I didn't actually bother doing any research to work out if this was the case or not, but is it seem that Mel Gibson per actor has been in more kind of these revenge thriller type things than most other actors would normally expect to be in over their career?
With most of them being remakes?
Yeah.
Yes. I think perhaps he has.
He must just like revenge fantasies then.
He spends most of his spare time fantasising about revenge. It's true. I've spoken to him about it. That boy's daft on revenge.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of the time it's revenge against Jews, but for perceived slights.
Yes. Uniformed Jews, yes. Oh, that Mel. What a character. You can't beat a bit of apartheid drama for awards worthiness. And how about a bit of a cookie-cutter sporting triumph story for good measure? South African rugby circa 1995 is what we need, I believe. And how about getting a hold of Morgan Freeman to play Nelson Mandela? The man's played God at least twice, so it should be within his scope. Even if he's not really available, he doesn't seem to mind phoning in his performances these days either. Now, we need a team captain for the national rugby squad. But he must be a white man, so that together he and Mandela can help unite a fractured nation and place it at the centre of the world stage for something other than institutional human rights violations. We need someone charismatic, someone whose screen presence is never anything other than electric, whose intensity grasps the audience's imagination like a vice and makes their emotions dance like a puppet to his masterfully acted tune. Ah, fuck it, I've got Matt Damon's number here somewhere. Drew, Invictus any good?
Well, yeah, fair.
The most cynical introduction I have ever heard.
Which I don't even recognize. I like Matt Damon.
Yeah, but he's not exactly Captain Charisma, is he?
No, there's Pienaar, though.
Yeah.
It's a very good film. I think you really hit on the nail on the head there in your introduction of suggesting it's cookie cutter, because as far as the sporting story in it, in as much as it is based on what really happened in the 1995 World Cup, it is a sort of, you know, shitty team inspired to become better and win a championship, albeit in this case with slightly higher stakes for the country involved. That said, though, it's got a great director and a very strong cast, so it's a typical sporting turnaround story, but just done extremely well. Very, very well crafted. It's very much worth watching. I think a lot of people will enjoy it. Nelson Mandela apparently wanted Morgan Freeman to play him, although that I've only heard from Morgan Freeman himself.
So you know what he's like when he's got a pint in him? He's always saying these things.
Yes.
Then driving home and crashing.
Yeah, apparently God wanted to be played by Morgan Freeman as well, so that's worked out very well.
You've only got Morgan's word for that as well.
As I say, it's very enjoyable when people get a lot out of it. The problem is that much as having their national team become something that the entire country could get behind, and the possible nature of that having brought the country a bit more together, the most interesting person is obviously Mandela, and it would have been a bit, I would have preferred a film about him and his politics rather than about the Rugby World Cup, because I saw the Rugby World Cup, but don't particularly want to see it again.
I've really got very little to add to this film. I mean, it is, in narrative terms, a fairly standard issue sporting underdog story that just happens to have Nelson Mandela in it for quite a lot of it. Doesn't necessarily make it any better, but it is just really well crafted, as Drew says. Got to have some respect for the script writing and the directorial effort, as they did manage to put some reasonable tension and excitement into games. Well, particularly the final itself, which I've only got a very hazy recollection of, but I remember it being dreadfully, dreadfully dull. And it actually seems quite exciting in this film. In fact, I think it might be, I can kind of vaguely remember it being about the same time as I stopped watching rugby. So it may have been a game so dull it stopped me watching the sport entirely for years. And yet on film, it's actually turned out quite well. So I've got to give them some props for that. And other than that, yeah, so I've very enjoyable film. I probably couldn't back it up with paperwork and evidence of saying it was great because of this, because of this, because when you look at it on a purely intellectual level, a lot of it does feel very standard issue and very kind of seen it all before. But it's just done very, very well and handled very, very well and very enjoyable.
Well, that's sometimes all you want, though, isn't it? I mean, look at something like The Hangover last year. That's a fairly standard issue comedy. There was nothing particularly original about it, nothing particularly different. It was just done so well that it made it very, very good indeed.
Nothing wrong with a good archetype now and again, and this one's done as well as any that I can think of.
Fair play. Who could want for more? Albert and Alan Hughes are proving difficult to pin down these days. The sibling directorial partnership behind breakout hits Menace to Society and Dead Presidents turned their hand to documentary with American Pimp in 1999, period horror with From Hell in 2001, and have only now emerged from extended hiatus with the post-apocalyptic actioner The Book of Eli. Starring Denzel Washington as nomadic wanderer and warrior Eli, the film takes us through his attempts to spread the word of a mysterious book among the desolate remnants of a nuclear war-ravaged America, all the while beset by gangs of bandits who are as happy to kill for fun as they are for gain. Can Eli bring salvation to the survivors of mankind's darkest hour? Just what is this mysterious book? Will Gary Oldman get bits of the scenery stuck in his teeth? Scott.
To be honest, if there's one thing this film could have done with it, it's a lot more of Oldman's overacting. It might have actually had some interest to it. I mean, I've always liked Denzel Washington. He's a very likeable performer, and he's made some otherwise mediocre to average films feel a lot more enjoyable than they are if someone less talented had been in the central roles. But he's not a miracle worker, and this uniquely pony action film lacks pretty much any action, and what action it does have is very poorly handled. So the guy's kind of dealt a bum hand to begin with. Plus, he's never really been much of an action guy at the best of times, and his advancing years mean that his performance gets even less believable when you look at this. Now, the problem with this film, more than anything else, is that it's quite excruciatingly boring. The plot's pretty much paper thin and has many ideas above its station that it just simply can't cash. it's not strong enough to hang a film around. The action's not strong enough to hang a film around. Basically, there's nothing here that's of any interest to anyone whatsoever. It's the dullest film I've seen this year. It is so boring, I couldn't even get myself worked up into a kind of furious rage over this absolutely ridiculous moral posturing and religious bullshit that it's peddling either, and so I can't really bother talking about it now. All I can say is just leave this film well alone. It's absolutely dire.
I'd rather you wavered a bit less, Scott, and just came to some sort of conclusion about it. Drew, are those sentiments you would share? Religious bullshit?
Oh, it's bloody awful.
Oh my goodness.
It's really buttock-numbing. Denzel Washington, as Scott said, absolutely not believable as an action hero at all. And it's terrible. There are ridiculous cliches in it, spectacularly stupid plot twists, all while absolutely nothing's happening for most of it. But what's good, and by good I mean irritating beyond hell, is the constant hero shots of Denzel Washington, the camera swooping down low beneath him to show him being really, really serious, powerful man. Once is kind of annoying. Every 3 minutes it gets very, very wearing very, very quickly. Yeah, it's shit. Avoid it.
Well, I haven't seen it. I thought it might be worth a look in, but you've made me realise the error of my ways.
Is that unequivocal enough for you?
Yes, that's quite. Oh dear. Based on the novel of the same name, Youth in Revolt is the first cinematic outing for TV director Miguel Arteta, and stars Michael Cera as Nick Twisp, a frustrated virgin staying in a trailer park with his mother and boyfriend, and occasionally spending time with his father. After encountering the beautiful Sheeny, played by a newcomer Portia Doubleday, Nick decides she's the one, but is intimidated by the presence of her boyfriend Trent. Clearly, the best way to impress Sheeny is to invent a rebellious alter ego by the name of Francois, and in doing so, Nick becomes more of a public menace than a sex magnet, landing himself in some serious trouble with the law. Drew, Michael Cera seems to be carving himself a bit of a niche as this kind of character. Is Youth in Revolt a retread of previous works, or does it have something new to offer?
The film's not a retread. I think because Michael Cera's style is quite so distinctive, it might feel like some of his other characters, like in, for instance, Juno and Superbad, but the film bears no resemblance to them. Fortunately, like those other films, though, it's really very, very good indeed. First of all, Francois Dillinger is one of the most awesome names I've seen in a film in quite some time, so plaudits to them for that. The plot is ridiculous, but fortunately isn't really the point. It's just some great interplay between the characters, some superb dialogue, deeply, deeply funny dialogue, superb sporting cast, like you say, Zach Galifianakis, Steve Buscemi, and the awesome Fred Willard. Don't really know how to put it. Just like it was bloody good. Perhaps Scott could do a better job. I'm rather failing at the moment.
Scott, do a better job.
So that's your all-purpose inspirational speech as a manager, isn't it?
Yes.
Do your job better.
It's a phrase I've become increasingly comfortable with over the past few years.
It's quite a clever role for Cena to take, I think, because it manages to both have him playing completely two-type as the kind of hyper-intelligent nerdy loader, and also play the exact opposite of type in the same film as Francois Dillinger. Yeah, it's in many ways genius. It is not believable in the slightest. It starts off far-fetched and gets gradually more ridiculous from there on in. It's another film I think has been mismarketed. I can only barely remember the trailers by this point, but it did seem to be pushing itself more as a kind of American Pie type romp team comedy, where it's not. Frankly, it's a far more measured and intelligent film than that. It's just an incredibly sharply scripted film. It's got some incredible use of language in this film as well. But again, Cena's delivery is more or less the same delivery he's done in all the films I've seen him in, but it's not growing cliched at all. It's still very funny, still very crisp and very eloquent, and that's what I like about it. None of the dialogue is even remotely realistic. It is a scriptwriter's wet dream, I guess, but it's not lines that people, especially of these kind of ages, would be comfortable with saying in any world that I'm familiar with.
They have managed to pull it off in a way that probably only Kevin Smith and maybe a handful of others have done too. It just looks ridiculous. It should stay written, possibly, but they do manage to pull it off and make it sound very, very amusing on screen.
It makes perfect sense in the context of the film. It's a very funny film. It is very, very sharply scripted, and I've found it very funny. There's a pervading threat of continual left-field chaos, which I find rather endearing throughout a lot of it. In fact, there's really very little in it that I can't think of that isn't a complete unqualified success. It's deeply, deeply funny. It's a bit early to be talking about funniest films of the year, but I think this might be in contention for it. I heartily enjoyed it and heartily recommend it.
Strong praise indeed. I'm looking forward to catching up with Youth in Revolt at some point soon. Michael Cera there, proving it's probably impossible to be typecast as essentially yourself. Ian Dury first rose to prominence on the British music scene in the late 70s when his band, the Blockheads, helped push the punk rock sound further into the public conscience. Stricken by polio at an early age, Dury's contorted, sometimes unsteady appearance was at odds with the 70s glam and 80s designer chic of his peers, and his willingness to explore social prejudices with unflinching focus and no small amount of wit often saw him branded a controversial figure. In Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, it falls to Andy Serkis to bring Dury, who succumbed to liver cancer in 2000, vividly to life in an attempt to allow us to better understand a man who many cite as one of the most underrated pioneers in British music. Drew, with a history like that of Ian Dury, there must be a fair amount of material for Serkis to get his teeth into here. Is this a successful biopic?
Well, yes, for two reasons. One, it's very good, and two, it seems to cover quite a chunk of his life, and I didn't actually know much about him at all, and I feel I do now, and that I can believe most of it, so I suppose that makes it a success.
Bonus.
Yes. What you might come away with, though, is the overwhelming feeling that if this is true, Ian Dury was a colossal prick. Well, there's a credit to his personality, the writing, or I suspect, actually, Andy Serkis's powerhouse of a performance. It's utterly, utterly compelling. Despite the fact the main character is so unlikable, you pretty much can't take your eyes off the screen and can't take your eyes off Serkis. He's superb. Although he is quite clearly insane, though. He's one of those nutter method actors who, instead of using CGI or some sort of camera trickery to show, and only a couple of scenes really where it's really clear his withered, polio-stricken left side, Andy Serkis went down the entirely sensible route of just not using his left side for several months before filming started.
Yes, method actors, stop being mental, please.
Yes. I mean, whether that's actually helped him make his performance good or not, I suppose only he knows, and you could only really know if you did it without having done that in the first place.
But you'd hope he'd feel a bit robbed by himself if it hadn't worked.
Yeah, but whether it worked or not, Andy Serkis's performance is superb. It's a very interesting subject, reasonably interesting period in British music, and I don't know what more to say. It's excellent with an excellent lead. Go and see it.
Scott, is it a film worth not using the left side of your body for months for?
You would have needed a bit more advance notice, I guess, than we'll be able to provide, given it's now left cinemas. Unless you wait for the DVD release. So yeah, I recommend not using the left hand side of your body until this comes out on DVD, then limp down to the nearest shop and buy it, because it's very good. It's very, very good. I would even suggest I liked it more than Drew did. It's an absolutely stunning performance from Serkis. Absolute genius. The film itself is like no biopic I've ever seen before. It's a combination of high drama and pantomime and all sorts of stuff. It feels more of a theatrical performance. It seems like this should be a play rather than it should be a film, which could probably sound like an insult more than what it's intended as, which is a true compliment. This is the one of the most unique biopics that I've seen ever. It seems, I'd imagine if Terry Gilliam made a biopic, it would look like this. So it's massively interesting on sort of visual levels as well as being informative and touching in places. So you're left with the impression that Dury is a bit of a prick. He's certainly flawed, but it's those flaws that make him interesting. So what are you going to do? But it doesn't shy away from showing his flaws and his mistakes, and he'll cop to them in places. He knows what he's done with his life, and that it all came across as being very human and a very touching performance and a very touching film. I liked it an awful lot. It's alternately very funny and very well acted and massively interesting. I'll mention the supporting performance of little Bill Milner from Son of Rambo as well.
He showed quite a lot of promise in Son of Rambo, and I don't recall having seen him anything since that, which is a pity because he's quite astounding for his age.
Very charming.
Probably the only person in this country that sort of age just now that's quite so good is Thomas Turgis.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of them seem to be in quite enough stuff.
Probably got some exams to be getting on with.
They were sensible backup plan. But no, this is a very enjoyable film. I heartily recommend it to absolutely anyone.
It's possibly, it's not really worth mentioning, which I will mention that Ray Winston turns up in it again to play Ray Winston.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't think about that, because if we did cover 44 in Chest, it would be like three Ray Winston films in one podcast, which is
recommended.
I think Ray Winston as playing this bloke from Essex's father is a bit more believable as Ray Winston than he is in some other roles, but still, it'd be nice to see Ray Winston not play Ray Winston for once. I think I've only ever seen it once in Cold Mountain. That was it.
I just, if nothing else tonight, I will take away with me your little quote there, Drew, of it's really not worth mentioning, so I'll mention it anyway.
The only real criticism, I mean, this has had, apparently, I've only kind of checked very briefly before we came on air, but it's had a fairly decent critical reception. The only complaints a lot of people seem to think that it had a bit too much Ian Dury in it. It's a biopic about Ian Dury. You can expect a fairly high quotient of Ian Dury content.
It might almost be impossible to have too much Ian Dury in an Ian Dury biopic.
Was that from The Daily Idiot or something? Some newspaper heard of it just resorts to pointing out the bloody obvious.
Yeah. Oh, there's too much music on this CD. I need to get rid of it.
It gets more plots too for having a character in it credited as Sulfate Strangler. I have no idea what that means, but it's brilliant.
Sulfate Strangler?
Yes.
That Sulfate had it coming.
Oh, and it also gets award for most awesome beard of the year, which I can't see it being usurped for Mackenzie Crook and his awesome beard.
Very cool.
Awesome. Will we chuck in 44-inch chest? Will we make it a Winstone hat-trick? Ray Winston's this geezer called Colin, right? And his missus has been doing the old dirty on him, right? So he's a bit broken up in that, and his mates are all like, Colin, what the fat are you going to do about this, Ponce? And he's giving it the old heartbroken routine like, so the lads have only gone and kidnapped the geezer, ain't they? Got him all tied up in that, and Colin can't make his mind up whether to crack his fatting skull open and live with the consequences, or let him go be the better man, as if God's sitting there watching from the bar shouting, Oi, Colin, leave it. He's not worth it, mate. Meanwhile, the lads are giving it the old, fucking let him have it, Colin, because he just want to get on with it and get down the pub. It's worse than an episode of fucking EastEnders, this. Scott.
Right, well, as I was sitting there watching this film, I was thinking, for the first half hour, God damn it, this is just bad. This is terrible. This is like every possible bad cliche you could have from a Guy Ritchie film, rolled up into one big ball and thrown at Ray Winston. But, and I'm going to stop this now because it's getting a bit sore. Then for about the kind of the middle third of this film is just a kind of strange nether region where it's difficult to really know what's going on. I think it was kind of coming round to its way of thinking by the last half hour. It's a strange film. I really don't know if this is some kind of deconstruction of the kind of almost now standard issue Ritchie London land and gangster film, which is now not only seen by himself, but pretty much anything that Danny Dyer's in, you know, it's all very, yeah, Cockney geezer. And this, and then after about 15 minutes, it turns into a study of mental despair of Ray Winston's character just having a breakdown. And by the end of it, I'm not entirely sure whether any of it happened, and it's just a kind of fever cheese dream as Ray Winston's left bleeding out in the first scene. One of the strangest films I've seen in a while. Whether it's actually any good or not, I can't really answer. I was too confused by most of it to come up with any kind of firm recommendation. It's really the sort of film I'd have to go back and watch again to make any sense of. It does have some halfway decent performances from, like, Tom Wilkinson. You see, the characters, it kind of confuses me because some of the characters seem to kind of be, you know, like, aspects of the central character, Colin Diamond's personality, and then sometimes it isn't, and it's just all a bit strange. If you like John Hurt swearing, you'll love this film. There's an awful lot of John Hurt swearing, so if that's
when you say John Hurt, do you mean Old Man Peanut?
I do mean Old Man Peanut, who swears. That seems to be his role. He swears. I don't know. It's a strange little curate's egg of a film. I can't really sit down and recommend it to anyone because I'm not entirely sure if I liked it or not myself. But when was the last time you've been left in that kind of state by a film? Which by itself,
but perhaps that's almost recommendation. Yeah.
Yes, it's certainly not what the first sort of 10-15 minutes sort of sets it up to be in the end. So give it a chance. Watch it to the end. Don't just dismiss it as just being a fairly dismal Ritchie-esque thing, which it's very easy to do from the first half hour or so. Give it a bit of rope to hang itself with, if you like. I don't know. I'm going to say yes. Go and give it a watch at some point on this. Perhaps wait until you can get hold of it without any financial outlay to yourself, so you're only wasting time, if not actually money. Yeah, worth a look. Very unique, very original.
Malcolm Venville directs.
Okay.
It's from the team that brought Sexy Beast, is it not? Is it the writers of Sexy Beast?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know if I've seen Sexy Beast. I'm sure I have, but I really can't remember a damn thing about it other than the DVD cover. So I don't know what's happened to it. I'm pretty sure I've seen it, but I
must remember Ben Kingsley swearing like an absolute tool.
See, that's what put me off of watching 44-inch Chess, is that I knew it was the same writers as Sexy Beast. I thought, I've had that DVD for about 5 years, perhaps I'll watch that first. And I did, and didn't think much of it at all, so I couldn't really be bothered with 44-inch Chess.
I absolutely loved Sexy Beast.
Thought it was pretty, well, bland and a bit crap, quite frankly.
Fight.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, check it out. Hopefully you'll have found something to stir your fancy in amongst that lot. If not, we will be back hopefully next week with, among other things, I think The Lovely Bones and probably From Paris with Love.
Possibly.
Anything? What else?
I think we'll be covering the new Hayao Miyazaki film too, Ponyo, and possibly a South Korean vampire film called Thirst.
So there you go. Yes, thank you for bearing with us once again. It's been a pleasure as always. I've been Craig, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye!
And Drew was Drew.
Fare thee well.
See you all later.
Bye!
Yeah! Rastafarianism! I love that tune.